Welcome to the Health Coaching Biz Shift, where we uncover the best strategies to transform your health coaching business to attract your soulmate clients, make your money, and leave your mark in this world. I'm glad you're joining us for the week-long virtual Health Biz Retreat, where you meet 10 of the kindest and smartest experts on marketing strategy, social media, and mindset. My name is Christiane Mohr, I'm your host, and I'm also a niching and marketing strategy mentor for health and personal development coaches. Our guest today is Joe Brianti. Joe is an expert in helping businesses to streamline and simplify their processes, specializing in CRM and email marketing. She uses her wealth of experience to advise on the right tools and systems to achieve company goals in a GDPR-compliant way. Joe's background is in technology. She began her career as a technical project manager for huge organizations like TUI and Transport for London. Joe qualified as a project manager and recently achieved the CDPO Data Protection Officer certification. In 2015, Joe founded JLB Business Consulting, focusing on helping small companies understand and then select the right systems for their data and marketing needs. Her clients benefit from her vast knowledge of systems and her ability to bring large-scale business analysis to small-scale companies. She's also the co-founder of Ealing Business Buddies, where she helps local organizations to network and access training. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, nice to meet you, Christian.
It's wonderful to have you here because when I thought about topics for the summit, I absolutely wanted to have somebody talking about GDPR. And that was for two reasons, because many summits are really narrowly focused on one thing, like list building or getting new clients. And I wanted to open that up for our audience because I think we need a wider perspective to be successful as entrepreneurs. And the second reason is that GDPR is really, it's like a myth and a topic where so many people are not certain what they have to do. And also a lot of misunderstandings around GDPR and what you have to do. So I really wanted to have that covered. And I would say, let's start with the basics, Joe, because this is where we need to go with that topic. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. GDPR is an EU regulation, which means it's mandated for every business to follow the regulatory processes within it. It helps you to manage the risks in your business from exposing your client data or your supplier data, and it protects your clients. So it is really worthwhile making sure that your processes for GDPR are correct and that you are looking after the data in your business.
Okay, so when you say it's mandatory, it means everyone has to do it. There is no leeway for small business or special industries. Yeah. You just have to comply.
You have to comply, but there is something called appropriate. And what is appropriate for a huge international conglomerate like BMW, Jaguar, TUI Travel is not the same as what is appropriate for a lifestyle consultant or a fitness consultant, or even myself. I'm a small sole operator. The way I manage GDPR is very different. Recently, as you know, I passed my data protection officer training, and I was on that course with somebody who was the global data protection officer for a huge firm with a presence in 20 different countries. So we both learnt about GDPR, but when we talked about how we would apply that in our businesses, we were talking in very different ways about how we would apply it and what we considered to be appropriate.
Okay, so this means that we can gather hope as solo entrepreneurs and coaches and say, okay, it might feel daunting, but it's feasible.
It is feasible, it is doable, and it is easy to manage when you understand the key basics that you need to attend to in your business.
Maybe let's just set the boundaries for what can happen if you don't do it, because there are a lot of numbers around there. And in Germany, yep, many suppliers of GDPR solutions said, well, you are facing fines up to 20 million or 4% of your annual turnover. So maybe can you go into that a little bit? What actually are the risks so that we then can say, how do we mitigate them?
So there are two levels of fine or penalty that can be applied to your business. And at the very top level, it is 4% of your annual global turnover, or up to 20 million euros. However, let's be realistic. Those kinds of fines are going to be for the most significant type of breach, and they will be for global organizations. If you are a single operator running a business that turns over 100,000 euros a year, there is no way you are going to face a 20 million euro fine. And also, when you think about being penalized or when you think about being fined, you need to think about appropriate, and you also need to think about, have you made the best effort that you can within your business to do the right thing? Because ultimately, there is no 100% guarantee from anywhere that you will never ever have a data problem in your business.
Yeah.
And the biggest risk in your business is the people in your business. Examples might be accidentally leaving a laptop on a train or a bus. The worst case scenario is that you get broken into at home or your office and your laptop or your desktop is stolen. Potentially, if they are not protected, that could be a data breach.
Yeah.
But that is not, you know, it's a way of managing it then to minimize the impact of that. And then if you do have to go to your supervisory authority and say, this has happened, but these are the protections I took and these were outside of my control, then working with your supervisory authority, you can A, minimize the risk of fines, and B, you can show that you've taken the best effort possible within the confines and the size of your business. So instead of focusing on the penalties and worrying, focus on doing the best you can to make sure that the data in your business is protected.
Yeah, I hear two aspects here. The first one is really do something and document it, because otherwise you can't show Absolutely. That you have done something. That's the first thing.
Yes.
And the second is also have the security of the data of the people who trust you in the back of your head.
Yes.
Or actually, no, it's yes. the forefront of your head. So this is what, yes. what would I not like to happen with my data? And I should make, as far as I can, make certain that that doesn't happen to the data of my clients.
Yes. And in data, in the GDPR, there is a requirement on you to include data privacy by design.
Yeah.
What that means is that privacy of the data of the clients who are trusting you is at the forefront of your mind. So every time you choose a CRM system, every time you choose an email marketing system, look at the data privacy policy for that system. Where is the data actually being stored? Is this a reputable company? Do they have good data security policies and processes? And that's your first step.
Yeah.
And if you're not comfortable, ask somebody who can talk you through that. Or if you're really uncomfortable, just don't take on that system, because that is your first line of defense.
I understand. So another point that I want to touch on is that because GDPR is driven by the EU, many people outside of the EU think, oh, that doesn't apply to me. But that is really a big misunderstanding, because whenever you're doing business with somebody within the EU, you are in the boat, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. If you are based anywhere in the world, you need to be able to identify your EU residents or clients, and you need to be able to demonstrate that you are protecting their data in line with the principles of GDPR. So it may be that in your email marketing system, you have a flag. It may be that in your CRM system, you have a country code so that you know whether your clients are in the EU or in the wider European economic area. So it's not just the traditional European countries. You need to think about Iceland. You need to think about Norway. You need to think about Switzerland, who are not EU members, full members, but they are in that economic area as well.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting that it's not just the EU, but also these is it adjoining country that couldn't or didn't want to do that step of being really yes. part of the EU on all the terms. You just said if, for example, in your mailing system, that you have to differentiate which people are from the EU or adjoining countries and which are from the rest of the world. That brings us to the point that many coaches have at a certain point in time that they wanted to bring something out that brings people on their list, and they need a GDPR-proof way to create a lead magnet and get people on their email list. What is your recommendation there?
Create your lead magnet in your usual way, whether that's a PDF, whether that's a Word document, whether that's a video that they access. But it's a way that you offer that and collect from your potential clients and your prospects their email address. There are two ways of doing it, or two legal bases that you can use. One is legitimate interest. So if you have customers, if you have suppliers, or people that you have a regular business relationship with, you can include those on your mailing list under the legal basis of legitimate interest. Mm-hmm. However, you do need to monitor that, because if somebody is a client for 6 months and then they slip off your list because they've moved on, they've ended the program with you, you would need to think then about whether they still have a legitimate interest. And the way you could do that is by monitoring those people. And it's very easy in tools to look at read rates, open rates, and those kinds of things. If you are offering lead magnets to people who are not clients, who perhaps come from your website, who are accessing these lead magnets as a way of building awareness about your services, then you need to look at consent. Consent must be given freely. So you must be able to provide the lead magnet to the prospect without them being mandated to sign up onto your mailing list. So the process that I advise people to do is the lead magnet is there, they sign up, and they get you take their email address, there's two ways that you either take their email address and you send them a link where they can download the lead magnet, and you invite them at that point to give you consent to sign up to your mailing list. And not 100% of the people who take your lead magnet will agree to receive your regular emails. The other way is that they get an immediate download, and then you follow that up and invite them to sign up and confirm that they want to receive the emails. But that's it. If they don't give you consent in either of those two scenarios, then you should not be sending further marketing literature, and you should not make receipt of the lead magnet dependent upon them giving you that email address to send ongoing emails, because that is not consent that is really given.
Okay, so this means that pretty much, I guess, 99% of all the lead magnet capture forms are actually not okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've looked at a couple of really big 6- and 7-figure coaches who do not do that, and they mandate that you sign up for the mailing list in order to receive the lead magnets. So at the very core, the consent is not freely given. Now, the likelihood of there being some sort of follow-up of that, might be minimal, but it's more about how you manage your processes. When I talk to people about this, I talk about people giving value through blogs, through maybe their social channels and 1-minute videos here and there talking about what I can do for you, how can I transform your life, so that when I do sign up to take your newsletter, I'm engaged, I'm aware of you, I'm looking to find more information about you and your business and what you can do to transform my life. Because the lead magnet is part of an awareness building process, and it's about building that trust, and that is part of the newsletter as well. So if you think about your customer journey, it may be that you spend more time building awareness of your system and your services and the transformation you give your clients in other ways before they actually come to the newsletter, so that they are willing to sign up and want that value add that you give them from a newsletter.
Okay, but as long as I don't have them on my list, it's a hit and a miss. If we talk about social media, it's really, they might see it or they might not see it. I'm subject to the rules of that platform that I'm using. So that makes it really hard to build a consistent communication unless I'm going to direct messages, which is not a scalable thing.
So what I always recommend is, if you're doing something, the asset in your business is your website, okay? So every piece of awareness, whether it is a social media post, whether it is a video, whether it is something, make it drive people to your website. On your website, have blogs, have really good information. And another way of doing it is, and I've started to look at this with a client this week, is all of her newsletters can be downloaded as PDFs. So all of her newsletters now sit on her website. Mm-hmm. So she has on her menu newsletter. So anybody who she drives to her website can have a look at the quality that's in her newsletter, all those tips and the content and all of the videos that she creates as Facebook Lives, for example, she downloads, she puts them onto her website. So it's driving traffic all the time, where people can see the value that she offers her clients. And then more people are willing to then sign up to her newsletter.
Let's say that's pretty much the other way around of how everybody else teaches it. So,
it is. And also the other thing is that where I differ to other people is that I tell people, it doesn't matter how many people you have on your list, right? So nobody else in the world knows whether you have 100 people on your list or whether you have 10,000 people on your list. What matters is not the number on your list, it's how many people on your list regularly open your email, how many people on your list regularly click the links that you send out, and how many of those are converting into business. Because you may find that as part of this review of your GDPR processes, that there are things that you can do to review where you are managing your business in other ways. And email marketing is a key one. I did a project on GDPR with somebody. We looked at her email marketing list. She had a large list, 5,000-6,000 people at the time. Mm-hmm. And when we looked at how many people were opening that list, her emails, or clicking through, by the time we had done a re-engagement campaign with the people on her list, lots of people unsubscribed, but it meant she had a smaller list. So So she was actually paying her email provider less money. So her costs reduced and she had a really nice, tidy list of people who were interested. And we knew they were interested because they were opening her emails. They were clicking on links. They were reading blogs. And she could directly tie that back to the bottom line and the revenue in her business. And that's what this is about. It's not about collecting email addresses to be GDPR compliant or to anything else. If you do these things to make money. And so GDPR helps you to look at all of these processes in your business and look at whether they are effective. And if they're not, review how you're doing it.
Yeah, that would also increase the overall KPIs. They say the opening rates and not 1 to 3% of my list will engage with what I'm doing, but it's then maybe, if I'm lucky, 30%.
A well-maintained list is also a requirement of GDPR because you have to demonstrate in GDPR that you are actively managing the data in your business. So if you have a list that you have not reviewed for 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, how do you know whether all of those people on your list still want to be on your list? And the way you do that is by looking at your open rates, you look at your click-through rates, you run a re-engagement campaign, and there is a balance here, right? Because people get busy. And I know that I receive email marketing and I don't open it for 2-3 months. I've been busy this year, especially with homeschooling and all those other things. So that doesn't mean I'm not interesting or interested, I should say, in the kind of material that I'm being sent. So a re-engagement campaign that says, hey, Joe, you know, you haven't read my email for a while. Have you been busy? Or, you know, do you not want to hear from me anymore? Please unsubscribe if you don't want to hear from me anymore, you know, because I don't want to clog up your mail list. That makes me go back to the newsletter and think, have I been prioritizing this? Have I just been busy? Or do you know what? My business has moved on. This content is no longer relevant to me.
It will increase the quality of your list if you do that. And what I hear from your words, it's about time to revisit your list maybe every 1 to 1.5 years.
I set up for clients 6-monthly re-engagement campaigns.
Oh, okay.
And with a lot of email marketing tools, you can put a single automation in. You don't have to do it more than once. You build it. And then once you've built it, you just let it run. And it runs in the background. And every 6 months, it takes a look at your email list. Anybody who, let's say, has not opened the last 3 emails from you, it just sends them a little note to say, hey, do you want to really read my stuff now? You know, you put it a lot nicer. I'm kind of putting words off the top of my head and all of those good. And then every 6 months, do it.
Yeah, that is good advice, especially with the automation, because then you really don't have to think about it. It runs in the background and it frees your mind for something else.
Exactly. And it shows that you are being compliant with GDPR because you are actively managing your list. And that is part of the GDPR requirement, that you keep on top of your data, you look at your data regularly.
So let's talk a little bit about the tools we're using on a daily basis, because Google and co, they are really everywhere and they're transferring all our data to the US, or they don't even tell us where they're transferring it, but very likely to the US. And as a German, or as we as Europeans are already breaking the rule when we're taking user data to the US, because the US, EU-US privacy shield got basically invalidated. So now we can't even hide behind that shield, as good as it may have been. So what is your recommendation when it comes to these tools?
So a lot of the tools do have hosting in the EU, but you have to work out how to identify which of those tools have that. And in some cases, you have to request it. Part of the sort of thing is that these big tech companies, you know, are doing things in a certain way, and it's taking them a long time to kind of get round to accommodating GDPR. Microsoft, if anybody uses Microsoft 365 products, Microsoft do something called geolocate. And what that means is that they know that your account is based in the United Kingdom or Germany or France or Spain or wherever. And they put your data on servers based on where you live, right? So if you're using Microsoft 365, there are ways that you can just check on your account, and if it's not in the EU or UK servers, in my case, you can ask for that to be changed. With the bigger firms like Google, you need to look at the privacy policy. They have a requirement to actually state in the privacy notice exactly where they are storing your data, because under GDPR, there is a requirement. And there is, should also be there somebody that you can contact, an email address, where you can contact and say, where is my data being stored? And you can ask these questions and they have to answer. And if you don't feel comfortable with the answers, then as a business owner, you can make a choice about, do I look for another tool or do I mitigate the risk? And there are ways that you can mitigate the risk by making sure that you have up-to-date virus protection, malware protection, that your laptop or your desktop has encryption on it so that it makes it more difficult for data to be identified, making sure that staff who are accessing your data using these tools have the same level of protection on their systems as well. It is really, really difficult as a small business owner to have the power to say to an organization the size of Google, GDPR tells me I've got to do this. How can you help me? But I think the more that small businesses do have these conversations, the more it kind of drives that, especially when you have EU and the European Data Protection Board pushing for these changes as well. So they're getting squeezed at both ends, but it will take time for them to make that full kind of transition. But it's not impossible. And my recommendation, my key recommendation, if you are ever taking on a piece of tech in your business, before you sign on the dotted line, have a look at the privacy policy. Read through. Some of them are really onerous, but look for the key things like security standards. Look for things like who has access to your data via that company. So, for example, if you are storing your data on Google servers, what are they saying about who has access to those servers to maintain it, who then have access to your data? Read through, look for international standards. In the UK, we have a standard called ISO 27001. That is a security standard. If that is mentioned on a privacy policy, then I know immediately, not in detail, but I know that that is a security standard and I don't need to worry, because you have to achieve a certain technical level to have that security standard. And sometimes if you're not sure, email the person listed on the privacy policy and ask them, what are the security standards that you apply to my data if I store it on your server?
Yeah, I went through the deeds a while back for a few systems, for example, also Zoom, and it took them actually 9 months to get back to me to tell me then that, yeah, I could sign a GDPR contract and that link sent me back to putting in another request. I was so fed up because, I got every few weeks, I got an email and they told me I'm still in line. After 6 months, I didn't even believe that I was still in the line, but then they came back after 9 months. And by that point in time, we were long over what you needed to achieve with Zoom. So another company. So it is really hard to get the right information, I think.
Yeah.
If you want to go over the privacy policy and get a little bit more. So I just said, okay, I'm using a German tool. But I have to say the usability is ways behind what Google offers. And I got asked by people who I work together, can't we put that on Google because that is so much more comfortable? And I said, yeah, I would like to too. Mm-hmm. But it's personal data that we have in that sheet and I can't put that into the Google Cloud. And I think it's really maybe also the point is you get the impression that everything has to be super secure, but it's really just when you're working with data of your clients. So whatever is your own data, you can still use the Google Drive or whatever. So sometimes it feels like it's everywhere, but it's really, you have to make a distinction between user data or client data and whatever you're putting out there, marketing materials, whatever.
Absolutely. I have several different storage. So things like my lead magnets, things like images that I might create for social media, anything that doesn't have any personal data in it, I chuck it up on Dropbox. And Dropbox store all of that in the United States. My client data and anything that I consider to be personal data, and especially if you've got health and wellness practitioners who are storing special category data, I use Microsoft because I know that Microsoft, I can evidence it. They store all of that data in the United Kingdom and they have a backup server in the EU, in Germany or France, I believe. So I know that my personal and my client data is protected because it is on Microsoft. But images, documents, downloads, anything that is not personal data, it sits in Dropbox. And you can use more than one system. I can see a point next year when I, to save cost, I will move everything into Microsoft and I will use my OneDrive. I've got a very, very large amount of storage space, so I don't need to pay any additional money out for a Dropbox account, and I'm protecting everything, and it's not that Dropbox is not a secure system. It is just purely about, as you say, the fact that anything I put on Dropbox is stored in the United States. And as health practitioners, special category data around health, about wellness, if you're asking about sex or gender or any of those really sensitive topics, that data should not go outside the European Economic Area. So you really need to look at how you are managing that. If you have no other alternative but to transfer that data, then you need to make sure that in your contracts, in your documentation with your clients, you make them aware that you're using Google servers or Dropbox servers or whatever other tech system it is, and that data is stored. And you do need to be very clear with your clients that that's what you're doing. And that is a mandated requirement in GDPR.
One thing that we actually didn't talk about earlier, Joe, was what actually is personal data, because that is also something that that doesn't come as, or what you wouldn't consider as normal thinking. For example, your IP address is personal data, because in the end, it can be tracked back to you personally. And this also means that you have to have a contract with your hoster for data security and all these things. Yeah. So as a German, I shouldn't use an hoster in the US? And these are little things that are basically not hard to change or not hard to do when you first set it up. You just have to be aware of it. And also about the health data, what you said, that is that's something that we wanted to touch when you first talked about that we have special data categories that are more prone to be secure than others. Also financial data or things like that, you really have to be super, super aware of how to protect them. Why is an email address that is out and about anywhere, if something happens to the email address, it's, you know, the fine would be not as high as if you have a break in your patient data.
So if we just touch on that, and then personal data relates to the natural living person, not so if there are people who sadly are on your books that have now passed away, their data is not included. It is only data about living individuals, okay? And personal data covers any data that identifies a living individual. So that could be a combination of name, email address. It could be their home address. It could be financial data. It could be health data, criminal conviction, sex, gender, as we've already mentioned. But it could also be the way that you describe a person. So, as an example, I live on a street of 10 people. And if I say to somebody, the man who lives at the house in the red door is named John, that is personally identifying him because he's the only house on the street with a red door. It is quite wide and quite broad. However, in the context of a business, you are likely to have names, email addresses, home addresses. As sort of support professionals, you will have some sensitive category data. And you do need to look after all of that data. Now, some of it you will have responsibility for. Some of it you can mitigate your risks by using third party. So as an example, if you are going to take online payments, there is a piece of legislation that is complementary to GDPR, and it's called PCI DSS. And that is about protecting online business financial transactions. Now, as a small business, that's quite onerous. So what I always say to people is use something like Stripe, use another payment gateway, possibly PayPal or WorldPay, any of these really reputable, because they've done all of that. Yeah. All of those processes are done and managed. And in your privacy policy, in your privacy statement, you say, I take online payments and I'm using Stripe. Here is their privacy policy, which shows that they are protecting your financial data. That way, you don't take credit card details, you don't take bank details, so you have minimized the risk to your business.
So, Joe, this is really a lot of moving parts, and I think you might have overwhelmed some people in the audience. What is your best tip to start the process and also where to look to minimize the risk? So the immediate risk, I want to say. I know it's a longer process if you start it, but what do we do first?
The simple, quickest way of understanding the data in your business is a spreadsheet. Google Sheets, Excel, whatever you use. And what you do is you have a list of all the systems and the tools that you use, and then you identify. So as an example, I use Microsoft, and in Microsoft I store the name, the address, the email address, the telephone number, and I just put a tick in those columns. And then I put a link to their privacy policy, which I have found on their website. And I now know what data I'm collecting, what system it's stored in, and whether there's a privacy policy attached to that business. That's the quickest, simplest, easiest thing you can start to do to understand what data you collect in your business, where it is being stored, and what you're doing with it. Very quick, very simple, and we all have access to a spreadsheet.
Yeah, and whatever I store locally on my computer, do I have to put that down too?
Yes, you have to, yeah. But I would say that if you are storing documents and personal data on the hard drive of your laptop, do make sure that it is encrypted.
Yeah.
If you have a Mac, then there is an inbuilt system called File Vault.
Yeah.
So make sure that's switched on. In Windows 10, if you have the professional version, there's something called BitLocker. Switch it on. That is very quick, very simple, and it's a very effective way of managing the data in your business.
Yeah. If we're talking about, because I think addresses is something that everybody has, email addresses, telephone numbers, maybe the birth date in the contact app. For me, that's Mac. Actually, my Mac is FireVault is on, but I actually stepped away from the iCloud because they couldn't tell me where they were storing the data. And I guess it would be the US. So I'm transferring everything just via my LAN here. But on the telephone, I just, you know, I have the code, but is that enough?
So you can also, either on Android or other phones, you can get encryption and security. You can go through your settings, set it up, or go into the App Store and download an encryption and security so that if the worst happens and your phone is lost, because let's face it, they are mini computers. It's no longer just the phone, is it? So download an app. And those are quick, easy things to do.
I think we got enough head spinning right now, Joe. And I'm so thankful you came with a gift that gives actually a lot of valuable advice on how to do the, or how to protect the different areas that we touched today. And yes. I would like you to tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, so I've put together a lead magnet with my top five tips for how you can manage your marketing in a GDPR compliant way. So I've put in some information there about security, about consent, about fines, just headline things to make you think. And I've also put in there an offer that people can participate in to get support if they feel they need some.
That sounds really helpful. So, Joe, thank you very much for taking the time today to introduce us to this important topic and actually break it down in a clear and an understandable way. And also let us see the light at the end of the tunnel and that it's not totally wacko, because I think that's what many people perceive, that it's just a wacko regulation that they have to go through the deeds and really it doesn't make any sense. And I think that is a myth we busted today. And thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure to have you here.